Greetings and welcome to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. And I'm your host, Lee Smith. Today we have an incredible guest. You probably hear all sorts of times, oh, the conservatives don't know anything about culture. They're not interested in culture. They can't tell stories. They can't write books. They can't make movies. They can't do this. They can't do that. All they care about is crunching numbers and stuff like that. Well, that's not true at all. Our guest today is a man who I think in many ways is really, he is really one of the drivers of culture from the right. He is the publisher of Encounter Books. He is the publisher of The New Criterion. And the reason I really wanted to speak to him today, I was reading an article of his from nearly a quarter of a century ago. And in the magazine that he edits, The New Criterion. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But first of all, I want to introduce the man, Roger Kimball. Roger, thank you for being here with us today on Words That Matter.
Oh, Lee, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, so we're going to get to the Julian Benda essay in a second. That's very important.
Okay.
So again, that's the reason. So, you know, we have to talk to Roger. But, you know, we've had a number of your writers on the show here on Words That Matter, a number of your great Encounter authors. We've had Paul Ray. We've had Paul Tice.
Yeah.
We had Mark Ramsey was talking about
the
comfort women
right,
hoax.
So you
yeah. guys are you are really on a terrific hot streak. Congratulations.
Thank you for that, Lee. Thank you for your support. As I was saying to you before you started, it's all part of my plot to take over the world. World conquest. That's our motto.
Yeah, well, you're getting there.
Starting small. We're starting small.
Well, no, you're getting there. So look, I mean, your book list, your publishing list does appear to be getting a lot. You've published great books through the years. But this list, and of late, it appears to be getting a lot more attention. Is it that people are looking for guidance on the right? Are people saying like, look, I don't understand the way the world looks. And thankfully these guys over
right.
here at Encounter are laying it out step by step.
Well, you know, I think Lee, that there is a great hunger for, I won't say guidance exactly, but let's say insight, a great hunger for, again, relevance is not quite the right word, but a great hunger for the significant. And let's face it, our culture is devoted to the ephemeral. It is devoted to promoting a kind of amnesia about where we came from, who we are, and in very large part, both Encounter and The New Criterion are devoted to battling what I call cultural amnesia. In my view, Socrates, I think you have a picture of Socrates in your opening credits, at least it's some noble Greek, I think it was Socrates, is just as relevant to us today as he was, 2,000 plus years ago. And I feel that way about the entire range of our cultural patrimony. Now, we live in a time now when even to talk about cultural patrimony will get you in trouble because the feminists won't like it because you're using the word patrimony. And they say, well, what about the sorority and so on? But that is exactly the kind of narrow-minded, bigoted, superficial response to the great cultural deposit that we have been entrusted with. That's part of our problem today. And as I say, both The New Criterion and Encounter Books are devoted to battling that prescriptive, bigoted form of superficial anarchy.
Roger, this is a terrific introduction. I would not have been able to do it myself. Certainly not like you, but it's a terrific introduction to the essay and the book I wanted to discuss with you. As I said, I was going through a back issue of The New Criterion, and I came upon an article from December 1992. The title is The Treason of the Intellectuals and the Undoing of Thought by Roger Kimball. Now, the main subject, the main subject here is Julian Benda, translated as The Treason of the Intellectuals. I will let you say it in French.
Right.
I wanted to start off, though, with, because what you were saying is fits in so perfectly with what you quote at the very end of the article, which is the epigraph of the book. And I will say this in English. The world suffers from lack of faith in a transcendent truth. What did you see in 1992? Because, again, I read this and I'm like, wow, this is, you know, okay, things... Things were trending in this direction in 1992, but now it's really different. What did you see in 1992? Then I'm going to ask you, what did Julian Benda see in 1928 when he published The Treason of the Intellectuals?
Yes. Well, you know, the French word is clerc, right? I mean, try his own de clerc. And that means, and it does, intellectuals is a good translation. It means not just professors, but people like you and me and people who write for the New York Times, people who write for genuine newspapers, as well as the people who write for the New York Times, pundits, media stars, those are all clerc. And the fundamental treason that Julian Benda saw was that they had given up on their vocation to tell the truth. And that's that that line that you quote from the end of the essay is implicated in that, because in order to tell the truth, you have to have at the back of your mind or in front of your in the front of your mind the conviction that truth is something that requires the acknowledgement of something that transcends us here and now with our petty concerns. And the treason that that Julian Benda saw then was a giving up on that vocation and the politicizing of intellectual life, the insinuation of political passions right in the center of the intellectual vocation. Now, everybody has their own has his own political opinions about X, Y, or Z. But what had happened, he saw, was that people had now corrupted the task of intellectual life by subordinating it to political passion. So he speaks somewhere of the intellectual organization of political hatreds. Now, when I wrote that essay, I was struck not only by the relevance of what Julian Benda had said way back there in the late 20s, because after all, those intellectual, the intellectual organization of political hatreds was gaining steam then. And of course, it rolled over all of Europe within a matter of years, where the, you know, the Nazis systematically subordinated intellectual life to the demands of political purity. In their own terms. And I was struck by the fact that back there in the 90s, something similar was happening in our culture under the banner of multiculturalism. Of course, what was odd about the ideology of multiculturalism is that it was actually, there's nothing multi about it. It was always a monocultural animus directed against the then dominant culture of the West. So that was back in the time of Jesse Jackson and Hey, Hey, Ho, Ho, Western Culture's Got to Go. Right. He led students across the campus of Stanford. That was the time when you had, you know, they used to be called Afro-American Studies, when they would tout the great achievements of the African way of knowledge and tell you about the ancient Egyptians who were said to be black, their contributions to things like nuclear physics and so on. I mean, it was quite insane. But still, that was a, it was a, you know, it was an academic fad, an academic trend. Well, what has happened since then, of course, we bring it up to our own time, is that those elements that were on the fringe in the 80s and 90s, multiculturalism and so on, they have totally taken over. I mean, you can't, the ideology, for example, of ever more exotic forms of sexual perversity, the transsexuals, the, I mean, it's just, it's a round the clock obsession with things that differentiate us and rather than unite us. The ideology of so-called climate change. And so it's we are really at the mercy of political hatreds now that seem to become more and more virulent, more and more surrealistic in their extremeness. And it's, you know, it's obviously different in many ways, but there's no guiding concept like anti-Semitism, unless, of course, it might be the anti-white ideology of some of our some of our critical race theorists. But it's quite amazing to watch this. If you go back to the 80s and 90s, when many of these movements were still in a sort of nascent, incomplete form. And to watch the way they have just steamrolled over our culture now. You can't read a major newspaper or magazine or look at a you know, an important television channel without being inundated by this stuff. And so I think that, you know, I'm glad you mentioned this, that 1992 essay to me. I'll have to go back and perhaps repurpose it because the idea that the core idea for in the treason of the intellectuals is that intellectuals had given up on their commitment to the idea that we are all in this together, that we share a common humanity. You know, you might come from Europe or Asia or Africa or Detroit or wherever, and you might have this particular ethnic background. And those are real differentiating things, males and females and so on. But you know, white, black, still we share a humanity in common that transcends that. And once you give up on that, you have started down the road to a very divisive ideology.
It's turned into sectarian chaos. You should definitely repurpose. Yes. You should definitely repurpose this essay, to borrow your phrase. And I what I want to ask you after the break, because we're going to cut away for less than a minute. What I want to ask you when we're coming back from the break is, what is your posture now toward that piece and that sentiment you had in the 90s? Are you surprised by how bad it's gotten? Or did you have a sense back then, and are you now, if only we'd been paying more attention, we all actually saw this coming. So we're going to pick that up after our quick break here. If you're watching on YouTube, please make the jump to Epoch TV. We're going to be continuing on Epoch TV exclusively, having a fantastic conversation with writer, editor, publisher, intellectual, the great Roger Kimball. So make the jump with us in less than a minute. We will see you again shortly.
You've got to understand that terrorism is an information operation. It's not a kinetic operation. Okay? You're not going to destroy an army. You're not going to wipe out American combat power. What you're doing is targeting American morale. That's kind of what happened in Israel. What they did is they went house to house butchering people in the most horrible ways, including rape. But they didn't hide it. They publicized it. They filmed it. They uploaded it because they wanted people to see. The second day of the attack, I hear a lot from people that armed civilians don't have no effect. They don't matter. Oh, no, no, no. If I'm leading five killers murdering innocent people and one guy shows up with a handgun, suddenly I have to reorient my entire squad, not on my mission, but on eliminating that threat. And that gives normal people the chance to get away, take cover, police build up combat power. So the idea of armed American citizens in a situation like this, a widespread rape and murder. It is a hugely valuable and vital tool.
Thanks for making the jump. Welcome back to Words That Matter, a modern day book club. And I'm your host, Lee Smith. We're having a great conversation with Roger Kimball. And right before the jump, Roger, I asked you a question. What is your posture, your position on this article now? Are you surprised? The article from December 1992. Are you surprised it's gotten this bad? Or were you at the time... And we'll take your answer in good faith. If you say that yes, in 1992 I saw how bad it was going to get, and that's why I was warning people. Or again, are you surprised by how bad it's gotten?
Well, I am surprised. You know, it is true that a good part of my writing tends to be polemical in the sense that that essay was polemical. Not all of it, but a large portion of it is attempts to provide an anatomy of a pathology. And that pathology I call the politicization of intellectual life. My first book, Tenured Radicals, was all about that. It was about how the politicization of the humanities had corrupted them. And this article is in some ways part of that project. It came out a little bit after I wrote Tenured Radicals.
I should just add very quickly, I'm sorry for interrupting, but I should just add very quickly, an incredibly influential book for people in the audience who haven't read it. Do yourselves a good thing and read Roger Kimball's Tenured Radicals. Really influential, really important book. Again, sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to make sure we underscored how vital that book is at the time and is still today in intellectual circles.
Yes. Well, I said before the break that I would have to go back to the essay that you identified and see about repurposing it. And there have been three editions of Tenured Radicals, actually. The last was in around 2008. But I'm thinking of updating that, too, because things are even worse now, which I thought that they had gotten about as bad as they could go, given the shape of our culture, that without really transforming our culture in important ways, they had kind of gone to a sort of ne plus ultra, something that we couldn't get much worse. Unfortunately, our culture, our political system is under siege right now. We have seen, I believe, the sharp erosion of the rule of law. Just, I don't want to turn this into a show about, or a talk about contemporary politics, but...
No, this is good. It's interesting how they intersect, Yeah.
Your viewers will it's been in the news a lot recently, will know that in Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 9, as I recall, it says that there shall be no bills of attainder or ex post facto laws. A bill of attainder was, of course, laws that were written to target a particular individual or group of individuals. And just look at what's going on right now in our country. Certain individuals have been targeted by the coercive power of the state in ways that would have been unimaginable a couple decades ago. And I think that phenomenon and that ripping the blindfold off the statue of justice on our courthouses is part and parcel of the phenomena that I was discussing in this article. Because one of the things I say there is I bring in the Platonic dialogue, the Gorgias, where one of the main characters is called Callicles. And his main contribution is to say that there is no difference between right and might, that power is the ultimate determiner of value, power. And that's really where we are headed right now too. We are headed to a situation where laws don't matter, where the arguments no longer matter. It's who has the power, who has the coercive power of the state, and who wields that. And that is a terrifying prospect, because not only does it affect our political life, it affects everything. It makes it really impossible to tell the truth about the world anymore. It's as if people regarded George Orwell's great novel, 1984, not as a warning, not as an admonition, but as a how-to manual. And that, if the fact that people are so willing right now in our most prestigious universities to say that, no, free speech is not an important value. What matters is virtue. And of course, we, the enlightened, are the sole arbiters of what counts as virtue. This is a totalitarian idea that one would have hoped would have been extinguished with the French Revolution. Robespierre, the great architect of the terror, talked about virtue and its emanation, terror. Virtue and its emanation, terror. He gauged the level of virtue of French society by the rapidity with which the guillotine separated the heads from the bodies of as many noblemen as possible. And we're not quite there yet, but we're coming pretty close. There are a lot of people in jail now whose main tort is to have irritated the people who are in power and who wield the power of the state. And that, again, is something that that the treason of the intellectuals and its successor. I also talk about a book that was published, I think, in the 80s by another Frenchman, Alain Finkielkraut, which is a kind of updating of Julian Bonda's book. And we are well down the path toward a very bad situation. Again, did I foresee all this? Well, no. I mean, one way in which I did not foresee it is I remember on Newsweek many years ago, they had the cover was I think it had a picture of some transsexual couple or something, and it said, "Is this the new big civil rights issue of our day?" And I said, "No, that's gone too far." But I was wrong.
How much when you're talking about when you mentioned Callicles before, and the idea that it finally all comes down to power. I'm not taking mm-hmm. that. I'm not taking that position. I don't believe that. But mm-hmm. but frankly, isn't that what we've seen? That in a sense, sometimes the Constitution, what you're talking about, the Constitution, bills of attainder, isn't the Constitution?
Yes.
It's not the paper, right? It's about the Constitution is a function of the mores and the habits of the people, and once. A powerful faction, right?
Yes.
Once a powerful faction says, "Look, we don't think that we have to follow this agreement anymore. We have more power than you, so we're going to impose what we want."
Mm-hmm.
How do we get back to the place where I guess the most cynical way to put it would be, well, we've managed to deter each other. Instead of shooting at each other, we're going to vote. That's how we're going to have our revolutions or our civil wars through elections, through horse trading on Capitol Hill.
Right.
If we've left that place, can we? Well, first of all, do you think we've left that place? If we have, how do we get back to it? If we can get back to it?
Yeah. Well, I think you put your finger on it precisely, Lee, because the Constitution is essentially a document to prevent the intrusive power of the state acting against individuals. That's what it's about. It's about preserving individual liberty and property, which is requisite for liberty. It's about preserving that from the coercive power of the state. Now, all of the laws that we have promulgated and so on, and even the Constitution itself, it only works, I think Madison said this, if there is virtue in the people. In other words, you talked about, I think you used the word shared assumptions. If you didn't, I'll use it. The laws only work if they are supported by a bedrock of a shared consensus that we're all in this together. That is precisely why James Madison in the Federalist Papers, in Federalist 10, warned again and again about the danger of faction. That's the word that you used. And when faction doesn't mean just differences of opinion, that's all well and good. We should foster a polity where differences of opinion are respected and worked through in a lawful way. But of course, we are now in a situation where we no longer have differences of opinion. If you're not on the on one side, it's not that you have a difference of opinion, you're a heretic. And what do we do with heretics? We destroy them. And can we get back to a situation which we had until a couple of decades ago, where the rule of law was really respected? I think we can, but I think it's going to be hard. I believe that this next election is going to be absolutely critical for the future of this country. But even if it goes in the way in which I hope it goes, I'm under no illusion that it's going to be a bed of roses. If let's say that Donald Trump is the candidate, let's say he wins, there's going to be massive unhappiness. Our choices, in my view, are a certain level of civil unrest and the suicide of the country. So
I agree entirely. And I know a lot of people, obviously, I believe that the upcoming election is very important, but I agree with you. I mean, it's important, but it's not decisive. It's a long fight. There's a lot at stake. There's a long fight, and it's not going to end with this election, whichever way it goes. And there is so there is so much to look. I mean, it's a big thing. Are we going to be recovering something? Or I see lots of people arguing. So, like, actually, it's impossible to recover what we've already lost. The constitutional order is effectively in ruins. So I believe I'm not saying I say this, but people believe something new and perhaps beautiful, even more beautiful, will come of it. But you believe that we can restore the constitutional order.
Yes, it will not be easy, but I think that is the alternatives that I can envision are all of them very unpalatable. And I think you're right. It's not going to be, this is not a task for a moment or one electoral cycle. It's going to be very long because we have been drawing on the capital of our political legitimacy for many years and haven't been replacing it. I mean, just look at our institutions, whether you're talking about academic institutions, political institutions like Congress or the Department of Justice, families, churches. We've been letting the air of legitimacy out of these institutions for years and years and years. And Adam Smith once said, there's a deal of ruin in a nation, and especially a nation that is as rich and as powerful as the United States. But there are limits. And I think we're flirting with those limits now. And it's going to be a very long task. And we began this discussion by talking a little bit about Encounter Books, where I'm the publisher. You and perhaps your viewers might be interested in a new project we are just now unveiling. It's called the Golden Thread Initiative. And it's going to be devoted to precisely this effort at reanimation, a cultural reanimation through books and symposia and so on. We published a book a couple of years ago by the historian Wilford McClay, called Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story. And it's intended to be an antidote to the pernicious anti-American, pro-socialist tracks like Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And I'm happy to say that that's getting a lot of traction. It's getting adopted by lots of schools. We have a new two-volume history of Western civilization by James Hankins from Harvard and Alan Gelzo from Princeton, called The Golden Thread, in fact. And that will also be part of this tradition. But we really, I began by saying in a jocular fashion that, we were on the task of world conquest. But actually, we are, because we want to provide a spirit of renewal for our schools and universities, because without that, I don't think you can have a political civil renewal in the country at large.
We started that. Well, first of all, Roger, however we can help here at Words That Matter to promote that new initiative, the Golden Thread, please.
Yes, please. We will. We'll be in touch.
That's great. Please let us help however possible. Yeah. And we started this conversation talking about Encounter Books, talking about the new criterion, talking about your writing, and me saying, not in jest, what a central figure you are right now, not just on the right, but a central figure in American culture, in American history. And it's been great having I knew this conversation would enlighten me. I'm sure it's enlightened our great audience too, the great Roger Kimball. Roger, thank you so much for being here with us today on Words That Matter.
Great fun to chat.
Great.
Thank you.
God bless you, and God bless all of you for watching Words That Matter. We'll see you in our next episode.
But what we've had since the 1950s is the CIA leaking to the news media here and building the careers of big journalists, mainly liberal journalists.
How the media and how the intelligence services have kind of intersected in strange ways.
What you have today is a wokeness that's permeated the whole intelligence community, but especially the CIA and the FBI. If you want to advance now, you have to subscribe to this. You get retired FBI people or CIA people and senior anonymous current ones endorsing the book and the products and saying, yes, this is a good writer. And so building the careers of these people who then become completely dependent on our intelligence community for their careers.